Well, I'm here today. It's been quite a long time since my last episodes on this podcast, but welcome back to the Underworld Party. My name is Dare. If you've never listened before, this is sort of like season 3.5 or something like that. 3.2, I don't know. But I'm here today with Matt Sparks, and I don't know a whole lot about Matt, which is also part of why I'm really excited about today's conversation. So I'll let Matt sort of do an introduction in a second. But what I think we're going to be talking about today is the intersection of the Meisner technique, which is an acting technique, which we will get into, which I've just started really becoming fascinated with in the last 6 months or so, and improvisation. And we'll get into the guts of maybe different kinds of improvisation, because I'm really interested in sort of like improvisation, not just as the Western sort of comedy improv, but also just like improvisational theater techniques in general. And so I'm interested, I think Matt was introduced to me by someone who follows my page saying, I think their partner or something, I think it's your partner, that you do this, you mix Meisner and improv. And I was like, wow, that's a thing that I've been looking for to talk with someone about. And so we finally made it happen. So here we are, 8 hours apart across the vast ocean.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. I'm really looking forward to this conversation and excited to hear that you have been doing your own looking into it, your own research as well into Meisner technique. So I'm very curious to see what your take on it is as well.
Totally. Yeah. So Matt, let's just do the sort of like 5 minute, press fast forward or rewind on the VHS cam from the 80s. And can you just sort of tell us your like where how did you get into this whole thing that we're gonna start talking about? How are you? How are you, man?
I was thinking I might answer that with a deterministic point of view and start from the beginning. But no, it's too far back. I took an acting class when I was in my 20s. I signed up for an 8-week course. I did the first day. They were getting us to do improvisation exercises. I did well. The teacher congratulated me. I felt, and I never went back. I was pretty sort of lost in my life at that time, with addictions and I think I found out. I think looking back on it, actually, I think I found it hard accepting the praise of the teacher,
Wow.
interestingly. I did a psychology degree a few years ago, and I came to the end of that, and I realized that I didn't want to actually be a psychologist, although there's lots of different types of psychologists
Totally.
out to choose from.
Yeah.
And so I said to myself, I'm just gonna trust it to fate and see what happens. Follow my desire, follow my passion. And a week later, I was trying an improv class. And I loved it, and that was it. And then, due to my job, I'm lucky that I'm time rich, and so for the next 4 or 5 years, I just dive straight in, and I did as much as I possibly could. And then the pandemic happened. So, yeah.
Oh, I like this too, because I didn't know you were a trained psychologist. And I'm not a trained psychologist, but I would say that I went deep into the sort of how does trauma function neurobiologically? Like how do we like how does this thing called the personality actually form, and like how do our cultures and systemic forces sort of shape us and all of this stuff. So I'm really interested in that kind of stuff too, which is to say like essentially like how we undo the sort of narrative indoctrination we're already inside of in sort of different cultures, right? Because every culture has a kind of this is the way things are. you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, as a kid, you realize that's a total bullshit, but you're like, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense. But yeah. I do think it's interesting, and I would like to sort of, you know, touch on it in this conversation, where it's like, and you don't have to sort of, you know, be, you know, how to say, you know, I'm not asking you to talk bad about anybody or anything, but I do think that there is something quite interesting about how many people sort of become disillusioned with psychology after sort of it being such a help for them. Maybe it like helps them get over their addictions, their attachment disorders, you know, like it helps them to a certain extent, but then they see the actual industry and how the industry operates. And they're like, wait, this actually doesn't, like, this doesn't really quite fit the ethics or the ethos of the model of healing. And then they have to end up going into art or something because it actually is a little more real or something, or a little less constrained or something.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's not the basis on which I made my choice not to become a psychologist. And I'm not a trained psychologist. Just a Bachelor of Science. Sure. However, but I understand what you're saying, that people might become disillusioned with particular details of the job and the way they're asked to apply their psychology training. For me it was the one I came closest to was being a therapist, and the only reason I didn't do it is because I'm not very good at sitting still.
Yeah.
And I did bereavement counseling for a couple of years whilst I was studying. And I noticed how, you know, there were points which I'd have to really keep myself focused on staying awake. So I thought, this is not the job for me. I need something where I can move around. I haven't really answered your question, but that's not really a question.
I think it's more like we all find the ways in which the sort of rule set by which we're told to apply something is actually not really healthy on some level. Like I'm a lot like you too. It's like I've done grief counseling and I wonder why people sit so still. It's like, this is crazy. Like, don't you want to like dance or sing or drum or like just kind of like, you know, like do a thing, like, because I come from like a physical theater world where it's like it's not very entertaining or even meaningful if like you're giving a monologue and you're kind of just like sitting. It's, you know what I mean, like there's a way in which humans convey and distribute and metabolize emotion, right? Like hand gestures and like different tonalities. But in the therapy world, we're taught that you're supposed to have this kind of like very even tone. It's like very strange, like suddenly walking into a church and you're like, wait, this doesn't make, it's like something happens. Like when you cross the curtain of that world and you're like, well, these are the rules now. And it's like, but, but I feel the need to like, you know, do this other thing that would actually move the energy in a different way, you know?
A friend of mine has a therapist who they walk together. Totally. That's how the therapist does his sessions. But the thing that came up for me that you just mentioned was the voice. And there's something about that, which I found in other spheres as well, such as storytelling. There's this mystical voice that gets adopted, and I can understand in storytelling because there's a performance there, although it's still a little bit sort of I'm a purveyor of mystic knowledge kind of voice, but then in a therapy setting, when if the voice changes, then that's suggestive of a performance. And to a degree, it's true. The therapist is performing, right? Because he's being a character of the therapist. When he goes home, he's not a therapist with his family. He's just, you know, a dad or a
husband. Yeah, hopefully not.
Yeah, but we have these voices, don't we? Yes,
we do. We have these voices. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in, so you got into this, we hear your story a bit. I'm super fascinated. What are you doing right now with the work? So tell me what your current situation kind of looks like. I know that we're kind of still pandemic, but tell me a bit about the last year or so, what's going on.
So right now I'm working out, it's obviously a process, but I'm working out how to. So my origins are in improv, like traditional improv, comedy, dramatic improv. I have a leaning towards dramatic improv, or even more specifically, organic improv. But I like all of it, and narrative improv as well. But now what I saw is a connection between the organic improv and Meisner technique. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, how can I use Meisner technique and put it into improv? Now I can teach Meisner. I'm currently still a student of Meisner, although I have been for a long time. So it's an ongoing practice. And I have taught some Meisner before, but I'm not a fully accomplished Meisner teacher yet. Who is ever fully accomplished? I don't know.
Yeah, I know. There's like a kind of moving target to it.
Yeah. So I'm working out basically right now. I'm working out because there's things in my technique such as the repetition practice, which you can't teach in one workshop. And so I'm working out how I can put Meisner technique into individual workshops successfully.
Yes.
And I've got my second one coming up. I've done one already. It went very successfully, but I'm completely changing it and doing something different for the second one to see how that goes.
Totally.
So that's what I'm doing at the moment. Yeah.
I love it. So a bunch of things are coming up for me. One is I'm very excited that you're sort of remixing the Meisner technique, because I think that like all practices have to be updated and adapted to different contexts. It's like, I do a lot of non-dual practice from Tibetan and Chinese and Asian lineages, but I'm such a big proponent of like, you have to remix them for the context you're actually in. Like take the essence, like find the root, and then sort of figure out how that applies in your setting and your life and your situation, rather than saying, well, this is how they might have done it 1,000 years ago. It's like, yeah, but that's 1,000 years ago. It doesn't make any real, it's like it makes sense on some sort of poetic level. On a poetic level, it's sort of transcendent, right? It's like, oh, there's a through line. Like, for instance, when you see some of Meisner's stuff, it's like obviously from dated, like VHS 70s kind of stuff, but there's poetic truth that is still relevant now, right? It's just relevant. You're just like, oh, that could have been said, you know, anytime, and it's going to work, you know?
Yeah. Are you referring to the videos you've seen of the repetition practice?
Yeah, the repetition, or just sort of like how Meisner was teaching, like there's these grainy documentary kind of videos, you know, like super terrible quality, kind of amazing artifacts of reality.
Is that after he had his operation?
Yeah, so he's got the voice box in and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And so you have to go, wow, I'm sort of watching an artifact of this living practice. And there are relevant truths, but I kind of have to have a bit of distance from that, because that's not what's happening now. Like, he's in a totally different reality on some level to what we're doing now, like 1970s New York City acting, you know, like you have to think about this time difference. Like it may be only, it's like 50 years ago or 30 to 50 years ago, and people think, oh, it's not a long time. It's like, no, that's a very long time. That's like pre-internet, you know, we're in a totally different context.
Yeah.
But
and he was teaching it for, it for 30, 40 years as well. So,
yeah. So there's this kind of thing that you have to look at and then go, okay, so there's this body of work and there's poetic realities that shine through, but then the application of that work is got to be different now, because we have to apply it differently. And maybe not even because it's, you know, better or worse, but because people aren't able to commit to the level of training that he was basically asking people from the start. And a lot of people are still asking people of this, right? It's like 4+ years of consistent training to do a thing, right? And that's just that. That's not like saying all the other things that acting requires. That's just saying like this one way of connecting with emotional reality or whatever you want to call it is called the Meisner technique. And it's going to be this like chunk of your life, which is similar for me to like Buddhism and other things. It's like you could get lost in the minutia forever and not even do like other things that you need to do in your life, because like that body of work is just so vast and complex, you know? So I like the idea that like you're taking something, it's not, it's like you're, it's not so sacred that you can't remix it. I think that that's the, a big issue you get to in a lot of this work is it becomes pedestalized and then you're like, oh, well, it has to be done this way. And it's like, no, like life isn't that neat.
I noticed for me, I think I'm assuming I sort of mostly pedestalized it myself. But I knew when I first started teaching, I couldn't even tell the people I was training with, because if it just felt ridiculous to, you know, to tell them that I'm trying to do what Tom, my teacher, does. So there's that. And then, but I noticed I started the same way with improv. I was also like, who am I? Like, there were some amazing teachers out there and I'm trying to do what they do.
Yeah,
and I'm
totally
doing it relatively poorly. But then I just adjusted to that and I brought myself off. I had an interesting thought. I either brought them down off the pedestal or I put myself on a pedestal. I'm not sure which one.
And either way, I think is a fascinating, like I've had to do that too with my trainings is go, you have to be bold enough to dare on some level to do the thing that is kind of audacious and kind of asinine, you know, like it's a bit of an asinine thing to be like, I'm ready to teach, you know, like whatever. I think that what I've learned in doing that, basically going from like teaching small children miniature acrobatics or like whatever, you know, like little things to, you know, teaching people about how to trauma and meditation and other things like that and acting techniques, is that in some way, as the teacher, you're the artist, and you have to tell people transparently, like, the way that I had to and still have to evolve my own understanding is to do this next challenge. And that next challenge is trying to like take on the mantle of this organizational body that I, because now you have to like write the curriculums and think about feedback and iteration, and you're not just a student anymore, like going, oh, I'm doing the exercise. You have to actually become a student plus this other kind of, you know, role that is like meta student, director, actor, friend, coach. You know, you have to actually do more. And I do think that like the next step in learning is to sort of, hopefully you're not like breaking yourself by taking on this responsibility, but on some level you have to dare to challenge to get to the next level of understanding the art form.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you were listing all the sort of roles there, I thought, oh, that's like being an improviser. Because when we're on stage improvising, I'm the act with the actor, with the director, with the writer, with the stage, you know, the blocking director.
Right. You're the props guy, you know?
Like yeah,
Foley, with the you're the Foley the guy. Like, I'll break some celery over here.
The set designer. Yeah. So yeah, it's a bit of sort of tangential, but maybe there's something to be learned from improv simply by doing that. You know, assuming many roles at the same time. But yeah, it's definitely more of a responsibility. And so what's been interesting for me is I've trained with I think like 13 or 14 different Meisner teachers now. One, two, three, four of which I think I really like, and probably three or four. And in there's a whole range, and some of them sort of teach this thing that's kind of like Meisner, but I think so they've perhaps missed some of the core ingredients. So I'm not sure it really is Meisner anymore. It's not traditional Meisner, at least. I was fortunate enough that my first teacher was very traditional Meisner, very, very good, a man called Tom Radcliffe. So he was my starting point. However, so all these teachers teach it differently. And I would say some of them, I hesitate to say it, but I think some Meisner can be, I think this is probably, this is not something about Meisner specifically. I think this is probably about acting in general, but you can have actors who teach acting teachers who don't benefit their students and can even damage them.
Yes. Psychologically. I mean, that's true in almost every art form that is essentially kind of like psycho-spiritual, right? Because like, I don't know about you, but I had some pretty crazy spiritual experiences doing theater training that were not really being able, like you couldn't really talk about it, you know what I mean? Like you can't really be like, I'm having this kind of non-dual experience. But that's why I kind of went into trauma, and I had always kind of been doing non-dual stuff the whole time, but then I really doubled down in the last few years to kind of integrate a lot of things. And then in some way over the winter, I've decided to more fully go back into theater. Like I'm actually like there was a pivot in my own heart to be like, oh, I need to focus more on this again and just take everything I learned with me. But the point is I'm saying is that like the same kinds of experiences now kind of all happen together. Meditation, tantra, therapeutic kind of interventions, like all constellations work, family, internal family systems, animism, ritual, and then all the things we do in theater, you know, like they're improv, like, you know, like improv is essentially like functional multiple personality, right? It's like you're learning, you know, like, and it's, it can be taboo to say these things, especially because there's a lot of people in a lot of pain, right? There's a lot of people in a lot of pain. They don't know how to manage their conditions, right? But from just a perspective of experiencing the experience, right? Like not judging it as like a malady or a salvation or anything, you know, like, who cares whether it's good or bad? But just from a pure experiencing the experience perspective, all of these practices that we've talked about seem to be the same thing with different words attached. They seem to kind of touch. It's like we all entered a room through different doors and we all call it a different room, but we're all in the same room looking at each other, sort of waving and being like, hey, what are you doing? I'm meditating. Hey, what are you doing? You know, I'm doing ecstatic dance, you know, and it's just like, but we're all kind of on the stage together.
So absolutely. Like different ways to climb the mountain, but we're all aiming for the same peak. The third leg on my milking stool is circling. So it's the same thing. It's trying to get to the same place.
Right. And you're just, authenticity, you know, sometimes you need a flathead screwdriver and sometimes you need a Phillips head, you know what I mean? Like, you're just like, what do I need? Like, I need a hammer. What do I need? Duct tape, you know? It's a tool bag, I think. All of these things are tools, but the instrument itself is what I am really interested in, is like, how can we play the instrument? And sometimes we do need to like go, oh, well, this instrument needs to get fixed and we need to like, you know, do this thing over here. And we call that Meisner or we call that, you know, Tantra or whatever, you know, whatever. But the point is that like, it's we're getting to the place where the instrument can spontaneously kind of self-correct or self-adapt, you know, adapt with, and then go from this kind of like struggle to actually kind of like almost like jazz improvisation, where there is an underlying form, you know, all these games, oh yes and oh, but then I can break that rule and that's more interesting, you know, like, you know, all these rules and then you know how to break all these rules. And then on some level, you throw it all away and you just enter the field and see what the fuck happens, because you already know how to fall back on all these things. So you're not even worried about it anymore. You're just,
I think at the point at which you can throw things away, then you're relying more on instinct.
Yeah, instinct, impulse, and the ability to play, which is not necessarily a predictable thing, right? Like you're learning all these predictable patterns. This is how you play this B minor scale. Okay, that's the pattern. I learn it. And then it's like, okay, now play music. It's like, okay, so clearly music is not the just that scale, right? It's like you have to do other things and you have to break the pattern and remake the pattern. And then someone goes, oh, now I feel something. It's like, yeah, because just doing the scale, you feel something, but you don't feel that. You don't like, it doesn't trigger some kind of strange emotional catharsis or something, you know?
Right.
And so the thing I wanted to talk a little bit, just to get a little more context for everyone, is you mentioned a bunch of different kinds of improv. And I'm really interested in why these names of improv aren't more widely known. And I have some clues about that. And one of my assumptions or hunches is that in the West, especially in America, where we have things like Second City, the Groundlings, you know, UCB, all these kind of like famous Western improv schools, right, of comedy, essentially, is that they're all kind of mimicking like the sitcom, you know, on some level, like not totally, but like there's this kind of sitcom-esque, you know, genre. It's like a genre. It's like if I were to say go do sci-fi, you would already know something about that. You would go, okay, so sci-fi is like aliens and other planets, and you'd have like some rooms that you're going to play in. But I think that when people say improv today, they don't really understand that they're already doing that. But it's because it's like improv has become associated with this kind of westernized sitcom style of sketch comedy. Like we're essentially improvising a bit on like SNL or something, right?
Right.
And the kind of improv that I originally learned came from more like European and indigenous clowning and physical theater, where like you're not really trying to hit a joke all the time. Sometimes you go into deep grotesque tragedy, and sometimes it's levity, and it's sometimes it's mask work. It's like super abstract. You're like, am I watching a dance piece? I don't fucking know. So for me, I come from the world of improv where it's a little more dreamlike and a little more surrealistic. It's not necessarily about trying to recreate a Western idea of a setup and a punchline. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's, so you said a bunch of things, which I'm super fascinated by, because I don't hear those words a lot here in the West: organic improv, comedic improv, dramatic improv. And I would just like to hear your thoughts on like how you're even organizing this in your own, you know, body of work.
Interesting. So I've trained in Florida and Boston, and I've visited Chicago. And I know a little bit about the theaters there, although the landscape has changed a bit because some of them are closed during the pandemic. But they kind of have sort of different philosophies. Some are game of the scene, some are more organic, some are support your scene partner, some are make bold choices. My personal for me, I probably got lost on the question here. So you were asking about what are my preferences, or what's my understanding of the different
preferences? It's less about preferences and more like how you even organize these very different worldviews that all use the same word called improvisation in theater, theatrical improvisation, or improv, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. So, as you were describing your clowning European use and roots in improvisation, I was thinking, isn't it interesting how there's this community, if you like, that says we do improv, and it's sort of like, oh, that's improv. Well, if improv is there, then what's over there? Well, it can't be improv over there. That must be something else. But it's not. It's improvs everywhere, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So that's interesting. For me, my how do they? There's narrative. I'm not sure where to go with this. With this question, and I don't know why. Why it's sort of
like rainbow vomit. You can rainbow vomit.
So, yeah, my favorite. I think I'm trying to find a way in to answer this without just sort of listing.
Yeah.
What they all are, and perhaps find a connection between them all. I mean, first of all, to say comedic and dramatic improv, I think if you're doing improv for performance, all forms of improv are both dramatic and comedic. Right. It's like saying physical theater. Well, all theater's physical.
Yeah, totally.
So there's, yeah, I think inherently improv for performance is funny. It's always, it's very difficult to do something purely dramatic. But then again, even something purely dramatic will have its funny moments, right? So
That's right.
But it's this idea that we can make mistakes, that we can mess up and enjoy those moments, and the audience enjoys those moments as well. It's like they're seeing two shows. They're seeing the characters, and then they're seeing the actors having these little moments where they wobble, and then get back on their feet. Yeah.
And so, I've never heard the term before. You organic improv. So, did you coin that term? Did you hear it before?
No. So yeah, organic improv. I think I probably first came across that training with the Nursery Theatre in London.
Oh yeah.
And so organic can, I suppose, can mean different things to different people. For some people, it could just mean like a slice of life improv. But that might not necessarily be a great, not a performance that you might enjoy watching.
Right.
Because I think theater in general is not the same as just life outside. It's a distilled version of that, which is more truthful, or at least aims to reveal things more.
Yes.
In the real world, we spend so much time and effort trying to hide things.
That's right.
And we don't want to see that done on stage. It's not interesting to see people trying to hide stuff. That's right. Want to see things getting revealed. So same in improv. So good organic improv. Organic improv for me essentially means, and my definition of this might shift over time, I'm not sure, but it means being authentically connected and responding emotionally with your scene partner.
Right.
That's it.
Good. Yeah. I love it. I mean, and to me, it's like I'm asking you just from your current, most up-to-date understanding, because I fully know that as artists, we become changed, and then there are for our ideas and definitions of the work or these terms changed because we are changed by them over time. So it's not like, you know, well, this is the definitive thing. It's just more like I yearn for having these kinds of conversations where we can actually, like, you know, we can kind of gather the energy, like gather and then point, you know, like we, oh, that's that. And
yeah.
That's that. Because for there's, me, there, yeah. Oh, keep going. Yeah.
I was going to say there's an interesting point at which authenticity meets creative choice.
That's right.
And at that point, it's, am I still being authentic? Yeah. Because I'm doing, and some people use the word, they sort of hide, if you like, behind the word authenticity. Totally. And it's really just their comfort zone that they're talking about.
Yes.
Like, yeah. I couldn't do that because that's not authentic. It's like, right. But if you took a risk.
That's right. Right.
And stepped out of your comfort zone, you might find. So the phrase I came up with recently is, trying something new is not necessarily pretending.
That's right. because
it's done with intention.
Is real. And the risk is real, and the experience you're having, if you are attuned to that experience and not trying to escape from it, if you're not trying to escape from your own experience, then that is essentially a large part of what we're seeing on the stage, is that a person actually reckoning with the consequence of their action or their risk taking, whatever that is, you know?
Right. Yeah. And that's, you know, when you can see the actor being uncomfortable on stage, or denying something because it keeps them comfortable, as opposed to doing it for the character's sake, then it's just not as good to watch. Vulnerability, I think, is what we really enjoy seeing in improv.
Yeah,
when a character, when an actor can go there and open themselves up, we'd love to see what's on the inside.
Right,
but that's difficult to do, and it's almost like it's in Meisner we teach it, the vulnerability, but I don't know a great deal about other methodologies in acting, but it strikes me as interesting that to be a good actor you do have to be vulnerable. If you're going to play somebody that's outside of yourself, you have to be able to you have to at least be aware perhaps of your defensive behaviors.
Totally.
Be able to override them.
Yes.
When you need to play different characters.
Yeah. And I would say, like, so I think vulnerability as a term, like all terms do, get kind of co-opted by popular culture and they become like pop. It's like pop vulnerability or like pop trauma. You know, it's like everything's pop, you know, everything has its like new fad way of being disseminated, which isn't necessarily nuanced and contextual. But
yeah,
I think vulnerability has gotten this problematic rap because everything's like a gradient spectrum, right? And that gradient spectrum hits all the colors. You know, it's like you look at your little color chart, you go from all, you have all the colors in this kind of gradient kind of field that, and you know, you can find the place in which one color and another color sort of start to become each other, right? And so I think that this idea that vulnerability is a thing we can do is less accurate than saying that vulnerability is kind of this colorscape, this gradient field. And that one way into that gradient field is to just start becoming more honest, which is to say transparent in your ability to communicate and express exactly where you might be, even if where you are is in deception land or hiding or defense. Like there's a way in which let's say I'm defending from something because it's a question's making me uncomfortable. And this is the improv scene, whatever. A lot of people, they'll get stuck because they're like, they think there's like only two choices. I either have to like attack the question or give in to the question, like the question defeats me. Instead of realizing that there's this moment where you as both the actor and the character can just say, wow, that question really makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Now, is that a defense? Yeah, it kind of is. It's kind of a defense. But is it also like less of a defense than like just ignoring it? Yeah, sure. It's like less of a defense, right? Because you could just ignore it. And that would be a bit like, you know. But there's all these ways in which I think honesty and even honesty about your potential hangups, defenses, whatever, you know, gets us into that level of vulnerability a little bit more. It's like the bathwater is so fucking hot, you don't get in it all at once.
You know? Right.
You're just like, I'll sit on the bathtub and put my hand. Okay. Mm. You know, this ability to kind of recognize where you're at and where the situation is at and sort of do this kind of thing that cats and dogs do. It's like, oh, I don't know. I'm going to sniff it out. I'm going to prowl around it. I think there's an honesty and a vulnerability there that I think a lot of people don't necessarily play. And for me, that's what organic kind of means. It's like you can play all of these hesitations, essentially, and resistances, but you can play them on purpose.
Yeah.
Instead of like this, I either have to do yes and completely and blow up, or I'm just gone and I'm not in the scene anymore because I can't deal with it. You know, it's like, for me, it's all of this, like, everyone's kind of nudging their way towards some kind of deeper truth, but we don't fucking know what the fuck that is, you know? You know?
Yeah. So that was something that I thought of today, which is, you know, we all think that it's conflict that makes things interesting in theater or TV, any sort of performance. And today I was like, oh no, actually, I think it's not. I think it's truth that's most important in the scene, and conflict is just a way to get there.
That's just a way. It's just a door. Truth. It's just a door.
Yeah.
It's like, well, if I introduce a painful situation, which is a kind of conflict, if I introduce something painful, it will kind of get people there quicker, maybe, if that's what the script wants to do. But I think in improv, where we don't necessarily have a script, so we don't necessarily have this sort of like arbiter of like the interrupting force, which is like conflict or something, you know, this kind of, okay, now the army's attacking. You're like, well, I guess that's what we're doing. You know, the army's attacking. You don't necessarily, you're more in these quiet moments where you have a lot of options to, you, one person could interject conflict because we're used to it, right? Like, I think a lot of times people just go to the conflict because A, we're used to seeing that be the thing that we're supposed to do or something, like,
yeah,
whatever that means. Western ideas of storytelling is this conflict mode. So someone might go there really quickly and sort of become the focus of the scene. But I think that there's a lot of what you're saying is like this poetic truth telling, this kind of like softer revelations, right? There's like these softer revelations if the actor, and this is why I want to bring it back to Meisner, because when I, here's where I was going with this, I figured it out. When I learned clown, so there's red nose clown, and then there's like other forms of clown which are not red nose, you know, there's like commedia dell'arte, there's buffon, which don't necessarily rely on the sort of innocent naivete of the red nose clown. The red nose clown, presence, connection, getting into trouble, making it worse, kind of being stupid and being innocent, you know, like this thing. In that model, the vulnerability is in the presence of the actor, not necessarily the things that the actor necessarily does. It's the willingness to find out where there's sort of almost like a hole in the ground and sort of fall into it. So it's not necessarily like, oh, I'm juggling. It's more like, if I'm juggling, I actually have to sort of go, well, what if I dropped it? Or like, what if I introduced a risk and played with the risk and like failed? And so it's not even necessarily about creating conflict, but more about creating or being present to the opportunity for something completely unexpected to occur, and not try to immediately solve it as if it was like a, oh, that was just a mistake in the script and we're going to kind of rewrite it, you know? So right. This vulnerability in clown, which I think is why I really enjoyed Meisner when I first sort of start to see it, because I was like, so in clown, you have all of these exercises that essentially get you to this place of deep confusion about your choice-making capacity, because you have to basically rewrite a kind of script of like, yeah, in real life, you hide everything and you don't want to make mistakes because they're costly and the world's a kind of dangerous, brutal place. And the clown has to be like kind of impervious to all of that. It's like, yeah, it's a dangerous place, but I'm going to like do this weird, stupid thing anyway. And like, I'm going to open myself up to be ridiculed, laughed at, pointed at, but really I'm a mirror, but I have to actually first allow myself to be a mirror, which is like, ha ha, you know, like, fuck, Jesus Christ, I'm terrible at this, you know? But with, and that can take a lot of, it's almost esoteric in a way, because it kind of gets you there in a roundabout way. You know, it's like roundabout physical theater exercises that are super kind of like ambiguously strange and impossible tasks that don't make any fucking sense, you know, like just dumb. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it's kind of like almost like occult wisdom, you know, it's kind of like occultish wisdom.
Yeah. Right? When you say dumb, it reminds me of games in improv that are just, they're just silly. They're just so silly. Right. And some people really don't like them, especially actors trying improv, because I think for them it feels like they've stepped back into a drama class from their childhood or something. But for me, I think that's the most beautiful thing I see on stage, is watching an improviser tap into that. It's almost like a companion to the evil shadow. There's the silly shadow. And if we can, you know, the one that wants to go and be silly, but do that boldly in front of people and show them. So I think those exercises that you're talking about, the ones that are dumb, that don't seem to make any sense, there's a reason for them.
Yeah, there's totally a reason. And so you can kind of enter this clown world where you're kind of doing nonsense that eventually makes sense, because you find a poetry in the nonsense. It's sort of like you enter into this field of absurdity and surrealism to a degree that actually, like, the viewer starts to make sense of it on, like, a meta level, right? It's sort of like a Rorschach test or something. It's like, this is complete nonsense, Jackson Pollock nonsense, you know? But then you do that long enough and suddenly you feel things and you're like, oh, this is actually, like, getting me subconsciously. I have no, it's not a conscious, logical thing. But the thing that I liked about Meisner and the way that they structured the repetitions is that, because I came from clown already, I could actually see how it was actually, like, in some way a missing link to get to that place a little bit faster through language and through interaction. Because for a lot of people with improv and comedy and clowning, it is a bit like, oh, I'm going to poke you, I'm going to squirt you with this water, I'm going to, like, slip on a banana peel or, like, throw poop at you, you know, this thing, you know, because it's like we're becoming kids again, and it's like, that's what kids do, right? But with Meisner, you limit things in such a way that you have this repeating phrase that is kind of so banal and in some way meaningless. It's just like a container. You have a black shirt on. You know, I have a black shirt on, you have a black shirt on, you know, it's just, like, fucking dumb. But through the act of doing this repetition, you actually get emotional clarity. You actually become more honest through a kind of weirdly, it is honest, but it's like, it's kind of like the deception that tells the truth. You have a black shirt. Yeah, sure. I have a black shirt on. Or you have a black shirt on. It's true. It's honest. But what it does is allows us to kind of find the real honesty that is actually very hard to name inside of this, essentially a clown game. Because this repeating thing, it's like, I know you are, but what am I? I know you are, but what am I? It's a freaking clown game. You know, it's just like, we're just going to repeat this phrase until we just die of laughter or something.
Yeah, okay. So... The repetition primarily, and I suppose there's a question I want to ask you before that, and that is, I was going to ask you, I can't ask you where you trained, because I probably wouldn't recognize it.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna, so I think I've identified four different types of teaching in Meisner. Actually five. And the fifth one will be the one that brings all of these four together.
Sure, yeah.
So the way I learned it with my first teacher, Tom Radcliffe, is he teaches all five, but perhaps with an emphasis on the emotional side of things. Yeah. So the defensive behavior and vulnerability. And then there's teachers who teach purely from an impulse, like, follow your impulse. That's the most important thing. They're not so concerned about, and they might not even allow you to make emotional calls, such as you're sad. Then there's teachers who focus on the risk, take risks. That's their primary, you know, perhaps they do a bit of all the other things as well, but they're primarily interested in risk. And I think the fifth one, and I've only the last one, I've only found one teacher that does this, and that's, she puts a real emphasis on the physicality. So she combines repetition practice with music, and her focal point is aliveness in the work. So I wonder if any of those sort of ring a bell with you from the training that you had.
Yeah, I mean, so I think, you know, when people are trying to teach it, they do focus on this word emotion, like be emotionally honest and react emotionally or react honestly, right? Like to sort of, and show us that rather than tell us that. So it's like, if you're angry, you would say, you know, you have a black shirt, you know, something there would, you couldn't just be like, you have a black shirt. You have to be like, you have a black shirt. Like there's a bit of physicality, and the anger comes through in the way that you just repeat the phrase or change it or whatever.
Yeah. When you say have to, that feels like a requirement for performance.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's like we're getting into sort of like these awesome areas of like, are you doing this to train yourself? Are you doing this to train yourself and have a different experience that the audience has? You know, because the audience having experience is different than the actor having experience with the other actor, right?
Yeah.
And I think they're all magical. But then you have to ask yourself, well, what's the point of this? Is it for you to have a magical experience together? But if we didn't have it, we're like, we don't care.
Well, I think the audience. So what I do to you, I'm doing to the audience. Mm-hmm. Now I could try and do it to the audience directly, and it wouldn't work. But the best way, but I want to impact them. There's yeah. our primary focus, right? They're the ones paid for the seats. But I'll do it, I'll impact them through you. So I'll make you feel something.
Yes.
And I'll hopefully make you feel it in a way that impacts you enough that you're like, whoa, and you have an authentic reaction. The audience is very perceptive. They see more than the actors do.
Yes.
And they believe you. When it's authentic, when they can tell when you're acting and not acting.
Totally.
So,
and I think that there's this thing of like what you're talking about, it's kind of like the voodoo doll principle. It's like the actors are taking on the roles that in ancient times would be like a ritual ceremony on behalf of the community. It's like, you're impacting me, but I'm now a metaphor for something else, you know, and you're like, we become these kind of larger metaphors for this kind of circular, like witnessing process, you know, it's like, and even the witnesses are now a metaphor because there's all these angles are happening. I see you, see them, right? I see you, see him, see her, right? Like there's a bit of this like crazy witnessing kind of magic that happens with the audience and the performer's witnessing the audience and vice versa. Like there's a lot of, and with clown, which is interesting, is that like one thing clown does is they say you must interact with the audience as well as your fellow clowns. So it's like you're breaking all these walls. You're going, I must interact. So this is why I like Meisner, because like it's giving you tools to interact with your playmates in a very particular way. But then when you take that into clown and improv and like break that wall of the audience, you can also take a lot of those same skills, even if the person isn't trained in it. Like this is the place where I, you know, this is like the constantly reaching for this golden apple or something, where can you be so into your craft that the person you're playing with can have zero training at all and still get it on some level, like still feel taken through a kind of process that is interesting and maybe poetic or revelatory or something.
The thing about Meisner technique is this is sort of more advanced theory, and I haven't actually got there in my training yet. Because as an improviser for a long time, I was only interested in the repetition practice.
Yeah.
So I didn't try going into text work or anything. And this is where more of that advanced theory comes in. However, I am doing that now. So if I'm up against the way I've heard it being talked about is if you're up against somebody, an actor who's really not doing a lot, there's various techniques that I can use I can use my imagination to perhaps put a substitute on that person. So, you know, instead of they're not doing the thing to make me angry, well, I can change that round. I can reframe it and say, well, every time they don't do something, it's because they hate me. And that's going to make me angry. So their absence of acting, I can use.
Right. Everything is useful at a certain point. Everything is material.
Yeah. Yeah. So it, no matter what you're up against, Meissen technique is a good training, because you mentioned earlier sort of using ourselves as the instrument. Meissen very much puts the emphasis on that this is the instrument, and living truthfully under imaginary circumstances. And in my mind, imagination is powerful, so I can imagine lots of different things to help me when it's lacking in the studio or on the stage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And for me, like, that is like when you start in clown, you're kind of starting there. You're starting in the kind of like the clown enters into a dream that only maybe they can see at the beginning. Right. It's like there is something about the like, you know, like you enter with this inhale. And then when you find your spot in the room, which is kind of arbitrary, but it's like whatever feels right to stop and start to have a moment of presence, right? That's the exhale, right? So it's like like you're learning how to kind of go, you enter the stage, it's a little bit like you're floating or a little bit, you know, even if you're like a hunching over, you know, it's there's the bit of like, you know, this like bated breath, you know, you're holding your breath on some level. And then when you find something, that's when the first moment of contact comes. And to me, it's like Meissner is actually kind of doing all of these things too. It's just doing them in very quick succession with another person using like a phrase.
Yeah, I had an image there of an actor walking out in sort of similar to myself. I've done a clowning class before, and you sort of walk out on stage and you're given an opportunity to do something that's going to amuse the audience. And if you don't do it, the teacher's just like,
okay. Yeah, exactly.
A lot of people cry in those classes.
I know.
And the way you said it was sort of walking out and with this feels like this holding your breath, this perhaps an anxiety. And then you see something and you... And essentially, you put your attention on something outside of yourself, and then you drop in and relax. And that's exactly what Meissner is teaching us to do. It's putting the attention outside of myself, specifically on my scene partner. And that's the way out of my head.
Yes.
And the way out of my anxiety.
Right. And, you know, when I practice my bootleg version of Meissner, I'm doing it on some level to sort of kind of shift gears in my neurology. Like I don't know if you want to, you know, talk about this process, but like I found very quickly that 20 minutes of repetition was like almost equal to like three times that in other kinds of warm-ups. Like, you know, you have to warm up a kind of thing or whatever, a kind of way of being, right? You're warming up a way of attending, right? A way of being with someone else. And that's a lot of what even Western improv is. It's like all these icebreakers, right? Just to get you out of your fucking regular shit, you know, so you can play.
Yeah.
But I found with like, you know, a very short amount of Meissner, if I focused on a few core things, like maybe my milking stool has three, you know, legs or something, you could do like an enormous amount of warm up, and then warm up and the exercise sort of become the same thing. Like, are you actually warming up now? Are you practicing? Does it really matter? No, it doesn't really matter. It's like the same thing. And I find that really good improvisers and really good clowns are also doing this, which is like they warm up with just smaller versions of the bigger thing.
Yeah. I mean, so in improv, some teachers, like, they don't, there's a movement for warm-ups and there's movement against them. You know, sometimes the warm-up is simply doing the thing. I like a few warm-ups personally.
Yeah.
But with repetition practice, you know, it's interesting. I've almost on two occasions taken repetition and done it on an open mic night in front of an audience who would have never probably ever seen it before. Unfortunately, on both occasions, the other person sort of pulled out. And I can say I can perhaps sense their apprehension to doing it. But I think if you do it well and you commit to it, it's a performance.
It's a
It's an
performance.
exercise. Now, you know, I'm only doing it in an open mic night. I actually wouldn't charge people
Sure.
to watch it. But the thing about a good repetition is that it is there's a communication there. The words are being repeated, although the call, the repetition can change as well, as you know. But yeah, it you know there's a story there happening in the emotional. So Meisen said the words are the canoe on the river.
Yeah.
And the repetition is the emotional currents underneath, and it's the emotional currents that move the canoe, not the other way
Yes,
around.
totally. And I, you know, recently my partner and I, you know, we were teaching a class about play and introduction of play, because a lot of people, they're really stuck. Like they didn't get the chances to play, and improv is really scary for them, and all these things are very like mountains, right? They're like climbing Mount Everest. So you have to like kind of do this thing. But you know, we showed them repetition, and of course they did repetition in one way, which was very like deer in the headlights. You know, they're like doing it and they're like, am I doing it right? I'm kind of very scared. It's like, yeah, you gotta get past it. But we showed them, like, we did it with everyone and we had everyone do it with each other. And then we said, okay, so now we're gonna show you what we do, how we do repetition when we're sort of like take the training wheels off. But it's still repetition. Like we've showed you this, like it's very boring. It's just nonsense. This is not, you know, that you know the basics, so whatever. So now you're like not gonna be surprised, but you can just still watch it as a performance, right? And we did the thing where we start with something regular and then we move to like the provocational. You're annoyed with me. I'm annoyed with you. You're annoyed with me. I think that's funny. You think that's funny. Like we move, but then we even go a little bit quicker. So where we're adding pauses and maybe like a little bit of clown work, like a tiny bit of clown where like, and the thing I say here is that in clown work, you're also using what the other person gives you as an opportunity to amplify what they gave you. So for instance, if we're doing Meisner and it gets to be like, you're annoyed with me. I'm annoyed with you. You know, this thing that happens, right? This thing that happens in Meisner. It's like, as you're starting that repetition of getting hit by the like, are you accusing me of something? You know, like this thing of like, huh, oh, I feel this way. You feel that. You're actually going into this dreamy place where you can actually like take it on a little bit more. So this is where like authentic and inauthentic start to lose meaning, because I'm authentically enjoying being annoyed, even though I wasn't maybe annoyed before, but the person provoked me and said, you're annoyed, you know? So it gets a little bit absurd, and you do have to make sure it doesn't go totally off the rails, because it can. But when you're playing with this kind of restraint quality where you're still trying to do the exercise, but you're also looking for the opportunity to play, which is finding the game, right? You're finding a new game inside this other game. You do that for a few minutes, and actually everyone sees it as a performance. They actually forget you're doing this fucking, they forget at a certain point.
They
And I
forget
find
that
that to
it's
be.
I've had that experience before teaching Meisner, where I've with beginners, and I've emphasized the fact that you know it's really good to watch you, and there's like you're just repeating stuff, but in my mind there's a story happening here. And the problem with doing that is that the students then think, oh, we can put a story in the audience's mind, and then they start trying to do things.
Yes.
And then I'm like, no, that's you're trying to make a story now. Don't just be authentic.
That's right.
So,
right. And that for me as the performer, actor, director, whatever, I'm looking to do things as almost plainly as possible, because if you do things very plainly with intention and presence, you find these amazing moments where it's like one move makes 1,000 miles. You know, it's like one tiny movement suddenly has like energy beyond what it should. And I think that, like, it's not like you're not doing things on purpose. It's like you're still acting. It's like if you hit that note, an F sharp on the fucking keyboard, but if you hit it with presence at the right time and you're actually paying attention to how it impacts the room, that's kind of what I'm talking about. It's like you're not just like all F sharp, you're like F sharp, you know, like there's something there that's a little bit more like I'm waiting to see how this actually, and I'm actually catching it, I'm actually like trying to harness all of that energy that's reverberating
I think there's the difference between pretending and authentically trying something new. So if I'm just pretending, I'm like, well, it's just make believe.
Sure.
Right? There's no real intention to make anybody believe that. Not even myself. When kids are playing, they're not pretending. They're actually being.
Yeah.
They're doing. They're really doing.
Right.
In their imagination.
They're into it. Like they're into it.
So there's an intentionality when you're hitting that F sharp and you're going, oh, what does this do to you? You know?
What does this do to me? What did that do to me? Like what's happening here?
Yeah.
Like how to become so interested in what's going on that actually in some way acting is like a useless term on some level. Like, because when you're really interested and into it, like these kids who are into it, they could learn some more craft and they could probably learn some restraint and editing. And like, there's all these things in improv that you have to learn to do. Oh, you're doing too much. You know, you have to like do less and give your scene partners a little more room, you know, like there's all these, you know, tricks. But I think the thing that like would behoove a lot more people is sort of like what is taught almost as the primary motive in clown, which is regardless of your act, your bit, your skit, your sketch, whatever it is, regardless of like what you think you're going out there to do. Oh, I'm going to do this thing where I juggle and then fall on a banana peel and then tell this bad joke. Okay, sure. Yeah. That's sort of like the window dressing, and everyone needs some window dressing, right? Your costume is window dressing. Like everyone's right. Got a thing, right? Everyone's got a gimmick, as they say in pro wrestling, right? It's a gimmick. But if you're not authentically, vitally available, which is to say presence and connection with not just your partner, but with your own self, the gravity, the room, like you have to be like touching, it's almost like you're touching space, right? It's like you're it's almost like sound is like you can touch everything, you know. This is sort of like the clown. It's like the clown is on some level, their skin is kind of alive, you know, like they're kind of like, you know, the tiniest sound, you know, like affects them from the audience.
They're using this ability, everything.
And you use everything, and you're also in some way harnessing chaos, because like there's actually too many options on some level, because if you're that aware and that alive and that vital and that emotionally available, it's actually a bit too much.
Yeah. There's a lot of sensory input there if your attention is on everything.
Yes.
And I suppose it's chaos in as much as you're not deciding which particular thing you pay attention to. It's telling you what to pay attention to.
That's the primary difference, is that like on some level you are being led by this impossibility field, this field of improvisational possibility, and you still have your skit. So you still have your marks, your cues, your lines, you still have all this stuff that you can sort of wrest attention away from this kind of chaotic vortex that's appearing in the space, right?
Yeah.
But that vortex is actually the baseline, is kind of what I'm saying, is like the ability to be available in stillness, right? It's like when you watch an actor listen or think, you're like, wait, how do, are they acting now? It's like, yeah, it doesn't really fucking matter. If they're doing it well, if they're doing it well, they are so in the moment. The lines on their face, it's like, it doesn't fucking matter on some level. And then they hit the line, then they hit the mark, right? They do that.
Yeah. Ask me an interesting question. All your questions are interesting. So just ask me a question.
So,
I'm going to play something here, but
yeah. So what is your favorite flavor of ice cream?
Vanilla.
Yeah.
So I don't know what that looks like, but I was doing sums in my head. Mm-hmm. I was just doing multiplications until they got too big that I couldn't really.
Right. You weren't thinking about ice cream.
No.
No.
It didn't matter, right?
It didn't matter. No.
So there's an example of what you're talking about, I think.
Yeah, and I love that because on some level, I don't need to know what you are and aren't doing on some level. Like, I don't actually need to know what is important is that, like, you were fully engaged with doing sums because I could see you engaged with something. Like, you were totally engaged with something. I don't know. It doesn't mean that it was, like, pleasant.
So, yeah.
You know? It's not about, like, oh, engagement is pleasant. It's like, no. You could be engaged in something that's totally not fun, you know, whatever.
Right. I mean, it probably would be more fun just to think about my favorite flavors of ice cream.
Right.
But
the thing I like about this kind of work is that, like, you get almost an infinite number of chances to try out things. Mm. You know, like you get a lot of, and in real life you don't get that many chances on some level. You know, like relationships and things is like, you don't get an infinite number of chances. You know, you don't.
I sort of think is improv a bit like a flight simulator or a holodeck or something. Where,
oh, the holodeck, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Right?
For sure.
You know, I can be the bad guy. I could say the wrong thing. I can dare to be lovely.
Oh my God.
One of my teachers, phrase he uses.
Dare to be lovely, yeah. Right.
Essentially be vulnerable in the low stakes, or even I won't say zero stakes, but be vulnerable in a low stakes environment as opposed to the real world, which is high stakes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So it's really a lovely thing.
I've loved this conversation and I'm cognizant of time. So I'd like to sort of do like a finishing run with you here, a little finishing segment. And I'm wondering if it's interesting for you to sort of talk about what you have upcoming, and maybe there's some questions out there. You said you were going to do another workshop, and maybe we can get into sort of like, maybe it's a secret and that's fine, but sort of like what you're thinking about as you sort of go into the next phase of the work, you know, for yourself at least.
I'm thinking about there's sort of three ingredients in an improv scene, looking at it the way that I'm looking at it. There's the story of the scene, the context, the situation. There's the physical reality, which needs to be mimed because we don't use props. And then there's the relationship. And what quite often happens is the relationship, playing the vulnerable, that's the most vulnerable bit. So that's the bit that's most difficult to do. So we rely a lot on our words. And exposition. I always stumble with that word. Sure. Creating exposition, you know, lots of exposition. So I'm looking at ways to remove that as a temptation. For actors, and I'm doing that by using tools from Meisner, tools and exercises from Meisner, such as something very simple, like creating the backstory for this couple in their relationship, whether they, romantic relationship, siblings or whatever it is, creating a backstory for them, very simple backstory. So then they can go into the scene and have that as their security.
Right.
And you might have a very opaque conversation where they talk, they know what their situation is, but of course they don't label it because they don't need to. Right. So they have this conversation. It's just like, yeah, the first line of the scene might be, oh, I'm really sorry I did that to you. And they might, and you might, there might be dialogue for the next 3 minutes, and you never find out what the thing was.
Yeah.
But you kind of don't need to.
You don't need to. And let me. So this is also something I'm trying to do with work. Is like, I'm using a phrase that I invented it. At least I think I invented it. But the point is I needed a phrase that combined improvising with devising. Because it's like, I do both, and like devising is actually really important for my work. It's not just like constantly going into scenes cold is like, I don't want to, it's like very boring on some level to me. It's like, so I call it impro devising because it's just like, no, it's both. So you're using the tools of devising and the tools of improvising without necessarily any hierarchies. It's like, look, if this scene needs you to have a bit of devised backstory before you go into the scene, I think that needs to be okay. That needs to be good. Like, you shouldn't be like, well, then now we're not improvising anymore. It's like, no, that makes no sense.
Yeah.
It's a sort of
purist approach to improv that it has to all be improvised. Yeah.
Yeah, which is like, I'm not interested in that as much as I'm interested in like, what are the conditions by which a improvised scene or even a partially improvised scene, like let's say we actually have a play that we wrote and devised, and in that play are moments where that are kind of like open spaces where like, okay, in this scene we're going to improvise something and then we'll hit the next beat and it'll be this thing that we wrote, right? Like you can even devise plays like physical theater plays, clown shows, where there's a trail of breadcrumbs that are kind of like set. You rehearse these trail of breadcrumbs. But in each little breadcrumb, there's moments for these improvisational tangents to occur, right? Mm. And you can kind of like have a show that has a bunch of little like shows. And by the end of it, you've done your bit, like you've done your pieces. Oh, here's the trail of breadcrumbs. This is the fucking show. But every show is also completely and radically new and different because there's these kind of openings in, there's like devised, improvised openings where like, okay, in this, we're going to play this game, and this, we're going to do this other thing, and this, we're going to find out. And the point I'm just making is like, to me, the ability to watch people do all of these tools and have them be like, make Legos, take them apart, make this dinosaur, take it apart. Like the ability to go, oh, these people have so many tools and they're proficient at them. And actually like they're showing me from the get-go that it's not just randomized chaos. Mm. It's that they're actually utilizing randomized chaos at the right moments to create something that is almost transcendent. And then they go back into a framework and I feel like, oh yeah, now I'm just listening to a story again. And I feel that, that feeling we get from watching TV and stuff where you're like, oh, they really rehearsed this and it's all lit. And it's like the both and-ness of this is really the kind of apex of where I'm trying to go with theater, is like to get enough people to understand that improvisation and devising aren't at odds whatsoever. Like they're absolutely they're working together to create a kind of heightened experience.
Yeah.
That is both kind of reliable, but also like very unpredictable and has surprise inside of it. But also like, yeah, you really want to nail that fucking monologue? There's room for that in here.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you can. I think the best devising is done with improv. Otherwise it's not devising. But something you said that was interesting. Remind me. Okay, so I have another project. So where I do improvised storytelling, and it's we just started out previously with my partner. We were doing just pure narration. So we narrate a story. Like he does a sentence, I do a sentence, or whatever, back and forth, just building the story together, narrating it. With my new partner, we're narrating and then popping out to act and then popping back into narration, popping seamlessly. The structure of the story is improvised as well. So that's going to be different each time. So I'm really interested by your description of impro devising. We're sort of coming to the end of our time, but interesting perhaps for another conversation.
Yeah, and interesting sort of after we play with these things, because I know both of us are like iterating forward all the time. But yeah, I'm really fascinated by it. Like, there are so many ways to tell stories. And I think that like, we often get stuck in these ideas of like, well, no, these are the ways to tell stories. And what you just described is another way of like, yeah, there's like a narrational storytelling thing. It's kind of like being told a bedtime story. But I don't know if you've ever like played with kids, or maybe you have kids or you've been a kid, but like adults love to break the rules. Like they read the story, but then they also do what you just said. Like they start to act out with the kid this scene that's sort of like inferred by the story, you know, like there's like a kind of cutout scene. It's not just, I'm going to read the book. It's like, oh, what do you think about that? Like they start to have a dialogue.
Yeah. The good storytelling.
Yeah, the good storytelling.
The ones that have enough time and are not too tired. Totally. Do that. Yeah.
Right. And I think that like that to me, like these, I'm really excited about the kind of theater that has access to all of these, like has access to what Meisner brings, but also has access to what all of these kinds of forms can do when they're put together, you know. Yeah. And I'm just really fascinated, and I'm super interested in seeing your work and what you're doing. For all the listeners out there, thank you so much. We will have all of Matt's data in the show notes, as we always do. But is there anything you'd like to plug, anything that you'd like to say at the end here, Matt? It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed this conversation. And the thing I'd like to plug, I think, would be for the international audience that I teach. I teach repetition practice, which is the foundation practice of my Meisner technique. I teach that online. I don't have any classes booked, or organized. But what I do is, if I'm approached by a minimum of two, let's say a maximum of five people, then we will set something up, and I can teach my Meisner technique online. Like, and it works very well online. During the pandemic, I've done repetition regularly, solidly throughout the you know, when we're on lockdown. So cool. I still do it online, actually.
Great. Yeah. It's good to know that stuff's available. Well, we'll put all that information in the show notes. Matt, thank you so much for taking time out of your day over there where you are in England, I suppose the UK.
And an adjunct to Europe, unfortunately.
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you so much, Matt. It's been such a pleasure. I'm really stoked to chew on a lot of these ideas and check out your work and stuff. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Cool. I'm going to stop the recording now.